The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. I've got a nice set of questions lined up today, and Jim's going to serve them up for us. We appreciate everybody sending in questions. If you want to send in your own questions for the show, just send them directly to Jim. Jim at jimhelps.com is the email address. Make sure in the subject line that you indicate that it's a question for the show. And lately, we've been asking one additional thing to increase your chances of your question being answered. In the subject line, indicate it's a question for the show, and a couple of words about the topic, you know, taxes or Social Security or annuities or whatever it might be. So, we'll wait for Jim to chime in here. He's rustling through his pile of questions as we speak. I'm sure we're going to start with a Social Security or an IRMA question, but we'll leave it to him to decide where we start on today's show.
Thank you very much. I was looking for a particular email, and I can't find it, and I really wanted to because he referenced IRMA in it.
While I'm going through maybe a Social Security question, you can always look a little bit more.
Okay. Although, no, I got both questions here. Okay. Oh, so what I want to get to this, I'm going to take a little divergence, folks. This is the first time you're hearing this as well, Chris. So you're probably shaking in your pants like, oh God, where's Jim going to go with this? So we got two emails recently, kind of similar. And it's something that I've been thinking of as well. So let me read this first question. You have no idea what I'm getting at, Chris. Let me read this first question, folks. And any feedback that listeners could provide, I'd be all ears. So we got an email the other day, Chris, that read this. I'm a longtime listener. Lately, my opinion is your Q&A show has become stale. IRMA, GPO, and spousal Social Security gets old when you hear it every week. But the recent episode with Paul, a taxateer, although I'm not quite sure I spelled it right. Listener, I have no idea if the way you spelled it was right either, but I knew what you meant, so in my eyes it's right. The episode with Paul, a taxateer, was a breath of fresh air. Much like I experienced the first time I started listening to your podcast 5 years ago. Paul has a great style that works well with Chris and yourself. Please keep making a fresh Q&A podcast. We longtime listeners really do get enjoyment from a fresh rather than stale Q&A podcast. Then we got this email in. A day or so after. Hello, Jim and Chris. First, a comment. And I like this guy's suggestion. So I am going to immediately, well, I'm going to put this out for Chris's vote, see what he thinks, and then other people can decide as well. But I think I'm going to have Jacob start with his first question. Both of these were constructive criticism on the Q&A show. And I have been thinking, honestly, folks, lately about changing up the format. It's one of the reasons, and I didn't let the bag out of the cat out of the bag. I almost said it wrong again. The cat out of the bag. It's one of the reasons I wanted the topic of the show in the notes, in the subject line. And I'm dragging them now into folders. And I thought, Chris, of doing dedicated Q&A shows to specific topics rather than random ones. It was just one idea of a few. Okay. But this guy begins with his constructive criticism of our Q&A show. And folks, I'm open to any suggestions. Please send them in to me as we look at trying to make I think there's only so much you can do with a Q&A show. We have to provide the A's. You have to provide the Q's. I don't know how to make it fresh and exciting. Yes, bringing on guests help, and we intend to bring our taxateers on. But again, it's only so much you can do with the format. Do keep that in mind. So he writes, first, a comment on your Q&A show. The show notes unnecessarily disclose the state the question comes from. This spoils the fun of playing along with Chris. Mm. I guess I could avoid reading the show notes until after listening, but at that point, I'm not sure why I would actually go back and read the show notes. I suppose there are cases where it would be appropriate to indicate the state because it may be an important factor in that specific question. But honestly, in most cases, I think you can skip mentioning the state. I never thought of that.
No,
I didn't realize we were putting the answer in the show notes. That's, did you?
I did not. I think it wasn't so much that he's putting the answer as he kind of, as he describes the question, and I'm going to say he, Jacob, who posts the podcast for us, writes the state that they're from. Listener from,
right.
Fill in the blank, but it didn't really have anything directly to do with the trivia question, but he was inadvertently divulging the answer. So, yeah, I don't think there's any reason why he needs to divulge that. And since we're playing, for as long as we play this little game, I think we ask him to not indicate what state it's from.
Okay. I like that. So that is one recommendation that I am going to make changes on. And maybe I don't think it'll appease the first listener who's saying it's getting kind of stale, but maybe it won't be as stale to that first listener if you can now play along with Chris and try to guess the state. I'm just saying, because we won't give the answer ahead of time. So anyways, very, very good point. But he now continues. He too feels our show is getting stale. I have an idea, though. You have, over the years, had several special categories of questions that you were trying to include in each Q&A show. For example, your Social Security, Irma, and then he put in parentheses, which recently disappeared without any warning, annuities, as well as the new question of the week. So I have an idea. Why not create a category of questions to add to the show? In other words, how about a category, questions from people who are already retired? I guess we could have a category, questions from people who are not yet retired. I don't know. Just his thought. I never thought of a category. Subject, we always broke it down by, but I never thought of by category. Although we did, when we talked about our process, we did do several shows, if you remember, on just minimum dignity floor and several on the fun number. Those are more categories. I don't know if those are subjects or categories. I guess that's up to debate. So my point is, Chris and listeners in general, I would like to make the show a little less stale. It's stale for Chris and I also recording it. It's, you know, every week we go through questions and then we wrap it up. And I was leaning towards, and this is where I'm asking for thoughts to our listeners, dedicating shows to particular subjects, whether it's a specific subject such as Irma, Social Security, investment, annuity, or category, like he said, questions from people already retired, questions from people not yet retired, Would you like a show dedicated to one subject or topic throughout the month? There's pros and cons to that, though, Chris. If someone doesn't give a damn about anything to do with Social Security, they're already collecting, they don't care, they're not going to have a show that week. Or somebody doesn't give a damn about annuities and learning about them, they won't have a show that week. Or IRMA or whatever the case may be. That's my fear. People say, well, this show is all for people retired. I'm not retired yet. I'm not going to listen. Whereas spreading it out gives you something different. And you can fast forward. That's why we put the timestamps. Fast forward to the questions that you want to hear. Any thoughts? Because we're going to open this up to our listeners to share over the coming weeks any ideas you have to make the show fresh. But also, would you guys like more center topic shows that cover one particular topic per show? Or do you like varied questions? Do you have any thoughts, Chris? Besides the state one, which I think was brilliant, yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
I think it might be nice to have themed shows, maybe not every week, but occasionally. And kind of like when we put out the call to people, hey, Paul's going to be on in a couple weeks, so here's your opportunity. Give us some tax questions. We could do the same thing and say we'd kind of like to do a show for single people in retirement, the unique aspects of being single in retirement, the pros and cons, if you will. So, you know, you single folks out there, why don't you send in your questions and we'll do our best to answer them on this show that's coming up. The reason why we'd have to kind of put out the call, in my opinion, is it's going to be difficult for us, if we decide on a topic, to rummage through hundreds and hundreds of historical emails we've gotten searching for matching emails to our topic that we've chosen. We kind of would need to generate these when the time comes.
It's not impossible, Chris. If you were as hip and techie as me, you would realize inside the Outlook app, I can search, like, we have an IRMA question today. The guy who said IRMA just disappeared, we stopped getting questions. But we have two now. So I needed to find them. So I typed in IRMA into the search box, and anything with IRMA shows up. It's how I find your Social Security questions. So
yeah,
we
but
can
I'm not sure
it.
That's a rudimentary way of filtering it a little bit, especially if it's just a single word. But
true.
Special aspects of being single in retirement, you're not going to be able to search that in your Outlook folder, is the downside. So yeah, I'd be interested to see what people have as suggestions on what they might feel would spice up the show or kind of reinvigorate the show. Because, you know, we've been doing it as just a standard straight up Q&A show for the most part, every once in a while. And it's been a while since we've had a special guest on, like we had with Paul. We can certainly try to do that a little bit more, both with tax folks, and then we've occasionally had estate planning attorneys in and long-term care experts in. I think we had one time Medicare.
Reverse mortgages,
you know, a variety of topics we've had guests on. And those were always interesting because it was fresh and new. So we could maybe consider a few more of those.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if we'll spice it up unless Chris wants to record the podcast topless. Then he could spice it up that way.
Well, how do you know I'm not doing that right now?
That's right. Well, don't say it now. You got to spice it up. Let everybody know you're sitting there in your home topless recording the podcast. That's spicy.
If people,
there you go, folks.
If people want to imagine that, they're free to do so.
But anybody have any ideas, please share them. I do appreciate the feedback from these two listeners. I love the one with the state. I'll tell Jacob to stop writing the states in there so people can play along if reading the show notes. And I do intend to try to change this up a bit, and we'll see what we can do. Not quite sure I'm going to be able to make it exciting or spicy, but hopefully add some new life to a Q&A show that can grow stale at times. Okay. Why don't we get to the Q's and the A's now that I took care of all of this? So do you want a Social Security or IRMA question? Well, let's be unique. We always lead with Social Security. Let's lead, this is exciting, with IRMA.
Mm. Okay. That's really, really spicing it up there, but let's go
for it. We're spicing it.
Yeah.
And Chris is answering it topless. So it doesn't get any more exciting than this. An Irma question being answered by a topless Chris.
Wow.
Okay. He does give a hint. So, and this is new because you have no idea what state this guy's from. So play along, folks, even if you read the show notes. I come from the state where a large region refers to people in the rest of the state as trolls. I think we had this in the past, so you should get it.
If we did, I don't recall that. So when I hear trolls, I think Scandinavia. And when I think Scandinavian influence, I think of Minnesota. So I'm gonna guess Minnesota.
You're close, but no cigar. But why does a troll make you think of Scandinavia? A troll to me is some thing with a big fat nose and lives under a bridge.
Yeah, but they're mostly from folklore in the Scandinavian region of the earth. Not that there aren't trolls other places, but they're really into trolls over there for some reason in Norway and Sweden. So that's where my mind went. That's pretty much all I can say. But I was
the
close.
Answer? Hey, you were close. Mm-hmm. The answer, Michigan.
Oh.
He said, youpers refer to people in the lower peninsula as trolls, since they live, quote unquote, under the bridge, like a troll does. This bridge is the Mackinac Bridge. I might have pronounced that wrong, folks, but
Mackinac.
Mackinac?
Yeah.
This bridge is the Mackinac Bridge, and it connects the two peninsulas.
Hmm. Interesting.
So a youper will call the other people a troll.
I guess I had never heard. We've obviously heard youpers before for the upper peninsula. I guess I figured the down peninsula would be dupers, not trolls, but...
A duper?
Yeah, whatever.
Youper duper?
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Anyways, Irma question being answered by a topless Chris. My wife is 63 and on Medicare due to disability since 2014. I'm 62 and have enough insurance through a prior employer's retirement program. I retired in 2020 and filed SSA 44 for my wife to reduce the Irma surcharge in 2021. However, I later decided to make a Roth conversion, which instead took us to the top of the 24% bracket. For 2022, I again filed SSA 44. Since I did not intend to do another Roth conversion of this magnitude, however, I later did make another Roth conversion. I guess this guy decides later to do conversions. Mm-hmm. After I modeled our tax planning window. So our Irma surcharge was reinstated for 2023. My question, I have not seen any notification yet charging me for the actual higher Irma we should be paying from 2021 and 2022. I know Chris says they will charge us, but how long is this going to take? It seems that based on my 21 and 22 tax returns, this should have already triggered their bill. That's it.
Well, I agree that it probably should have already triggered the bill. I've heard from people that they've received notification of this chargeback, if you will, or reinstatement of Irma when they were previously granted relief fairly soon after tax returns had been accepted by the IRS. And of course, your tax return information is shared with Social Security and Medicare to make these determinations. And so I am a little puzzled by why you haven't received, because it sounds to me like you are definitely affected by Irma in 21 and 22, assuming that you were getting Irma while you were still working. I know you mentioned that you had retired, And at the end of 2020, the 2021 IRMA would have been normally determined by your, 2019 modified adjusted gross income. So the fact that you filed SSA 44 implies to me that your 2019 income had been, pushing, would normally have pushed you into IRMA for your wife, since that's the only one of the two of you who is on Medicare. So what can happen is an SSA 44 gets filed and then your circumstances change and then you contact them, and I have had people rescind their SSA 44. So that can happen when you thought you were going to do one thing and then you ended up having a different situation and then you regret having filed the SSA 44. If you find yourself in that position, I would contact Social Security immediately and request that they ignore your SSA 44 or you pull it back or rescind it or whatever wording they want to use. Can't guarantee, I haven't seen specific rules about when that can happen or not, so I can't guarantee it's going to happen for you, but it's certainly worth the request if it's going to be, if you find yourself in that regretful situation after the fact. Everything you've described, though, tells me that you should, in fact, be paying IRMA for 21 and 22, and somehow it hasn't clicked. My mind is going to COVID hangover. Not that I'm personally experiencing a COVID hangover, but rather the COVID hangover that Social Security is, has been experiencing in processing things, and including the IRS, which is the source of the data that's going to flow over and trigger kind of a reexamination here. So maybe there's some clogging of the system still, and there's still paperwork piled up somewhere that is waiting to be fully processed, and this maybe wasn't a priority, and it's going to take a little time to clear through the system. Or you might luck out and it never gets caught. Somehow it just never gets reviewed. It falls through the cracks. It's always that possibility too. So I can't point to a specific reason why you haven't gotten this notice, but for those people in a similar circumstance, you should assume you will get that notice after you do file your taxes and maybe do what this person did, generated more income than you thought you were going to generate when you filed the SSA 44, and they initially grant you relief. And then after the fact, when they reconcile everything and they get your tax return, they're going to do what's called trust and verify, where they trust your claims when you file the SSA 44, sometimes ask you for some minimal paperwork as support, but for the most part, they trust your claims. But they write in that agreement that they're going to check. They're going to wait and then get your return for the year. And if it's different, if you actually do owe IRMA, they're going to come back to you for it. And that should have probably happened in this case and hasn't yet. So I do think it's an extra long time that you're experiencing, and people shouldn't assume it's going to take that long. There's something stuck with yours, particularly your 2021 at this point. Usually not long after your tax return is filed, this stuff clears through the system. So I wish I had a more direct answer and not just supposition, but that's the best I can do on this particular one.
I think you did well. I mean, and it was exciting, folks. So you should do them topless more often.
I'm a little spicy, as you put it.
Chilly spicy.
Now. Yeah, I'm a little chilly.
Yeah. Well, then you'll have to get warm and spice it up again later. Okay. Now we have Social Security questions. If you want to do those, please say yes, because I have them ready.
Yes, I definitely do.
Thank you. And now we can play along. Okay. See if he gives a hint. He says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Thank you for your very educational podcast and the great retirement planning advice you share with your listeners. Your different areas of expertise and contrasting styles complement each other wonderfully. And your non-scripted extemporaneous presentation for you thought you didn't think I was going to get that word, did you?
I think he probably threw that in just to test you.
Your extemporaneous presentation format always creates very informative and entertaining podcasts. I stumbled across your show a year and a half ago and follow you regularly. Now, he is definitely mushing it up. So I appreciate that, folks. Could be why his question is being answered. Just saying, folks. Okay, here's his hint. Wait a minute. He put, however. Okay. Remember last time I read the answer? Because he said, after moving around a bit, my wife and I live in Florida. And I thought, oh, no, he's not going to get me like that other guy got me. But I can say Florida because it has no bearing to his question. Okay. He says, my hint, after moving around a bit, my wife and I currently live in Florida. However, for your trivia contest, I am from two states that share a Red River Valley. And I'll give you a hint. No, it's not Texas. So he's from both states that share a Red River Valley. So there must be a Red River.
So I have to guess two states? This is too much.
This is too much. Yes. Two. This is the excitement. That guy wanted excitement. Nothing is more exciting and spicy than a topless Irma question followed by a two-state trivia question.
Can you give me one state and I'll guess the other one?
No, because then you just have to figure out what state is touching.
You're pretty quick on that.
Gonna get pretty early in the morning to fool me.
I suspect there's Red Rivers in a number of places in the country. There's no Red Rivers in our neck of the woods.
All right, I'll give you one hint since you're floundering like a fish out of water.
Yeah.
It's cold in these two states.
Oh. How about North Dakota and South Dakota?
So close. But yet so far. North Dakota and Minnesota.
Oh, that was pretty close.
You were close. Zed, so close, but yet so far.
Yeah, I don't think I would have gone that far north had you not made your comment. So thanks for getting me close.
Okay. Alrighty, Social Security question. My wife is 65. I'm 68. My wife has filed for her own Social Security. I have been planning to delay mine until 70 to maximize our benefit. As you explained on your podcast, once I file for my own Social Security, my wife will qualify for an additional spousing offset. Her full retirement age of 66 and 10 months is just 4 months prior to my age 70 birthday. He goes on to say, since her maximum spousal offset at her full retirement age is prior to my age 70, I'm wondering if I would be better off to file for my Social Security benefits prior to reaching age 70 so my wife can claim her full spousal benefit as soon as she is eligible. And then he goes on to explain it a little deeper, but I don't think it matters. Can you answer that question?
So it is true that there's no benefit to spousal benefits. There's no advantage or increase in spousal benefits, maybe is a better way of saying it, for waiting to claim them past your own full retirement age. So if she were eligible to receive the spousal benefit, claiming it at her full retirement age would make sense because waiting any longer than that provides no increase to the benefit. However, there's one key factor here, which he's picking up on. She cannot file for a spousal benefit until he has filed for his own benefit. Hard stop. There's no adjustment to that, no exception to that. So he has to unlock the door. So he's wondering, is that enough justification for me to file 4 months prior to age 70 and take the permanent reduction to my age 70 benefit? Because if he files 4 months earlier than he otherwise would, he's going to reduce his benefit by a third of 1 year's delayed retirement credits. So if we essentially about 2.7%, so just under 3%. So his benefit will be permanently reduced by that roughly 3% figure. He'll gain, or at least the household will gain, the spousal offset for the spouse for those 4 months. He doesn't share any dollars, which is, I think, the critical factor here. How big is the spousal offset? If it's just a little bit, I would argue a permanent reduction forever of your age 70 benefit is probably not worth it. If the spousal benefit is fairly good sized, then it may very well be totally fine, and the sacrifice of the long-term size of the age 70 benefit, which we like people, when possible, to have the higher benefit recipient wait until 70 to claim, for the sole reason that when the first of a couple passes away, the lower benefit disappears and they're left only with the higher benefit. So there's going to be an automatic cut at the death of the first spouse to help minimize the effects on the household of that cut. We propose that the higher benefit get as big as possible, and you do that by waiting to 70. That's just our preference in most cases, I'll admit. Not every single case. There can be other factors that suggest a better approach, and some people just are philosophically or in other ways opposed to waiting until 70, and they might make a compelling argument for their own situation. But that's kind of how we view the value, where this kind of strength of what Social Security can bring to your retirement, that longevity protection piece, we highly value. So that's, he was kind of leaning towards that, but he's saying, hey, what if I, you know, does it make sense for me to sacrifice a few months of that? It's all going to depend on that trade-off of the spousal offset, that extra bump that she will get if you open the door a little earlier for that 4 months. If she waits the 4 months, she'll forego that spousal offset for the four-month period, and it'll be gone forever. There's nothing you can do to get it back, and then you'll open the door for her when you hit 70. Your benefit will be its maximum size, and she'll get the spousal offset bump, and you go along your merry way until the first of you passes, and then the survivor will be left with just that age 70 benefit of yours. Whoever lasts the longest will keep that one. Doesn't matter whether it's you go first or she goes first. The survivor will retain your age 70 benefit in that scenario. Probably not a lot of sacrifice for claiming it 4 months early. You know, 3% isn't a ton, but kind of depends on your overall longevity picture and your secure income picture when compared to your minimum dignity floor, if you're kind of following our approach, and whether that 3% down the road with all the compounded cost of living adjustments and everything will make a meaningful change in your future longevity protection. Maybe not. So could be an easy decision to go ahead and claim that early, get those extra 4 months, and maybe it's enough money to take you on vacation an extra time this year or something like that. And that might very well be worth the trade-off. You'll have to look at the numbers yourself and come to that final conclusion.
All righty. Perfect. So I'm struggling behind the scenes to make this exciting per hour.
Well, take off your shirt.
Oh, that would be way too exciting. Plus, I'm in front of a window. The traffic would just come to a grinding halt. It would be horrendous. So I will skip that.
That would be its own form of excitement. I'm in a quiet.
People would hear tires screeching. They would hear women yelling and hooting and hollering. It would be very embarrassing. So we won't do that. Okay. So what we're going to kind of do is jump around, because the next Social Security question is kind of an HSA question as well. So I want to meld two together, okay. But I want to do a quick annuity question now as well.
Okay.
So let's jump to the annuity question. The hint, I think you're going to nail this hint. And I will not begin with the way he begins, just in case that would be giving away too much of a hint. You'll see what I mean in a second. So I'll begin with the second line, not the first line of his email. Love the show, your information and your wit. My state hint. Now he gives five separate hints. I think he wants me to read one, see if you guess it, read the second, see if you guess it. So state hint first. Our flower is the yellow hibiscus. Either you know it, you don't. Tell me to move on to the next hint.
Georgia.
And okay. Our state bird is the nini.
A what?
Nini.
I've never even heard of that bird. Is this place in America?
Nini.
That doesn't help me at all.
Okay, move on. Our state fish is the trigger fish. So now you know it at least borders water.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, no, it could have water in it. I don't want to give too much away. Maybe it's a lake fish.
I think, aren't trigger fish saltwater? If you're going to give me a fish hint, I need to know freshwater or saltwater.
Saltwater.
Yeah, I figured they were saltwater. Okay, trigger fish, nini, South Carolina.
Okay. Our governor is Josh Green.
North Carolina.
We were the 50th state in the union.
Oh, Hawaii.
Right. And he begins his question. Aloha, Jim and Chris.
I always forget about Hawaii. A lot of the mainlanders, I think, forget.
Forget about Alaska and Hawaii.
Yeah. Because it's
The Y of vowels. A-E-I-O-N-U-N, sometimes Y.
Sometimes Hawaii.
We have 48 states and sometimes Alaska and Hawaii. Right.
Yeah.
No, okay, very quick annuity question, all jokes aside, to the point, like me, pithy. I was just wondering, are you ever going to teach us questions that we should ask an insurance agent before buying an annuity from them? Hmm. Pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just my opinion. You could Google it, questions to ask an insurance agent. I'm sure it would pop up. But a couple of things to recognize. The difficulty of becoming an insurance agent is rather low. And please, if you're an insurance agent, don't write nasty letters to me. You know, and I know, it's one exam administered by the state. It's not an overly difficult exam. It takes most people a couple of hours to study. You pass the exam, you're good to go. Then each state is going to require you to do, Colorado requires me to do 24 hours of a continuing education credits in a 24-month term every 2 years. Also, not difficult for me to do. I do so much continuing education classes and courses as it is for my CFP, and just because I enjoy doing it, I'm never stressing to get my continuing education courses. Many states allow self-study to be done, so you just sit at home, read a online website, read some exam that they're going to give, some little class they're going to teach. Others, if you attend, quote unquote, a live seminar, either in person or online, you'll get credits. It's not hard to get the credits. So my point is, it's not a difficult hurdle. There's not much barrier to entry. It's not like trying to become a physician or an attorney or even a qualified mechanic on these new vehicles that are out there. There's not much that has to be done to be an insurance agent. So it's difficult trying to figure out if you're getting a good agent or not. So this is a good question. And again, you can ask them, what is your background? How long have you been offering insurance? What lines of insurance do you write? If you're going to someone and their specialty is property and casualty or Medicare or healthcare in general, what do those people know about annuities? So you would want to know, what lines of insurance are you active in? Do you regularly write? And if you're specifically buying annuities from someone and you're going to go to them specifically for an annuity, you want to make sure that annuities play a very big role in the insurance that they write. again, they'll probably play up their continuing education that they have to do and the course that they had to take. I'm just here to tell you, that's not that difficult. So don't get swayed by the way that sounds. Even in the CFP world, we have to do 30 hours of study every 2 years. It's not that difficult. It truly isn't. The CE requirement, I think, makes the regulators pat themselves on the back, make it sound like they're doing something wonderful. But if you're active in my industry, whether you're going for CFP continuing education credits, insurance continuing education credits, trust me, folks, it's not that hard to get. Instead, how long have they been offering annuities? You probably know, if you listen to this podcast, a lot about annuities. Quiz them. Ask them some questions on them. What can you tell me about a multi-year guaranteed annuity? What can you tell me about a fixed indexed annuity? What can you tell me about a single premium immediate annuity? Go in there and quiz them on the type of annuity you're interested in buying. Don't go in and ask about a variable annuity if you're looking to buy a fixed annuity. Conversely, don't ask them about a single premium immediate annuity if you're going to buy a MIGA. But you guys are great. You all do-it-yourselfers. You're very knowledgeable. You're the VGs. You probably know more than the agent selling them to you. So go in and start asking them some questions. Just, you know, what can you tell me? I'm interested in buying a multi-year guaranteed annuity. What can you tell me about them? And then if you can, have a couple of questions about them to see if they can answer them adequately, or at least to your satisfaction. So in addition to asking them how long have they been doing this, I would ask them point blank, have you ever had a complaint filed against you? Have you ever had a regulatory agency look at you for something? Because that information is difficult to find on insurance agents. Sadly, in our industry, the financial planning industry, and Chris, you'll agree with this because we see it all too often, financial planners will be dinged by either FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, if they were acting as a registered representative of a broker-dealer, they'll be dinged by FINRA. We have seen someone in the Fort Collins area who not only was dinged by FINRA, they were barred for life by FINRA to ever work in the capacity as a registered rep again, or to work in the securities industry again. And that person simply became life insurance licensed and hawks to this day equity indexed annuities till the cows come home. I'm disgusted by that. I wrote to the state of Colorado to report him. How can you ask? And they do ask us every 2 years when I renew my license, have you ever been barred by any regulatory agency from participating in the securities industry? Have you ever had a complaint filed against you in the financial services industry? If they're asking these damn questions, how can he still have a license? And why don't you, the state of Colorado, you clearly know this. I even gave them the suit from FINRA. I gave them the link to FINRA to see it. Why aren't you at least putting it on the website? Because he touts on his website, hey, check me out on the Colorado Department of Insurance website. You'll see I've been an insurance agent since the 1990s. Looks beautiful. Why the hell doesn't the state tell you all of this crap? That's what ticks me off about the insurance industry. And the regulators don't talk to each other. Now, yes, you could ask an insurance agent, and I'm sure if you were to ask this one, he would probably lie to your face. No, I'm clean as the cows, or clean as the pure driven snow, whatever that saying is. Clean as a cow. Cow's not clean. But anyways, he could lie his way out of it, but it's a question worth asking, because most people don't lie well or will say to you, yes, I will freely admit I have had something filed against me. So what you can also do is get that insurance agent's name, full name, and check him or her out on FINRA's website. See if you can find it, Chris. Just Google broker check. Is it finra.com/broker check or something like that?
If you just Google broker check, it comes up immediately.
Yep. Broker check is managed by FINRA. And if you put in the person's name, and assuming they ever operated as a registered rep of a broker dealer, then they will be on FINRA. You can look up me and Chris right now.
Yeah, actually, Chris, I wanted to add, too, that FINRA has some kind of cross agreement with the SEC now. And even if you were never a registered rep, if you go to BrokerCheck to search, which a lot of people don't know the difference between them, they hear about BrokerCheck, they go to look, and IARs wouldn't come up. Now, if you're an IAR, it pops up on BrokerCheck, but simply says, this person's an IAR, go to this link at the SEC to learn about them. So I know that because I come up on FINRA BrokerCheck, although I've never been a registered rep. So it surprised me when I popped up on there. But when you look at it, it just provides a link to the SEC website where you can check RIA firms and IARs that work for RIA firms.
Right. And I'm glad Chris mentioned that because I didn't realize the two were finally talking. So I used to be a registered rep of a broker dealer. So I appear on FINRA, but I'm also an investment advisor representative, IAR, of my own firm, which is a registered investment advisor, Jim Song and Associates, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Huge mouthful there, huh, folks? So I appear on SEC's website as well. So what I would do is get the exact name of any agent you're willing to considering utilizing for an annuity and check them out on FINRA's site and SEC's site, because it's quite possible they've had regulatory issues with those regulators that their state insurance regulator has no clue about, or like Colorado, doesn't seem to really care about and let you know about. It's good for you to know these things. If you're going to be dealing with an agent who's been barred for life by FINRA, you might want to think twice with working with that agent, or at least question them about it. And again, I have little faith in the state insurance regulators of tracking this. Now, there's 50 different states, and they're all at different levels of efficiency and effectiveness. So there could be some states well on top of this, and much of what I'm describing might not actually happen in your state. But again, ask them about their educational background. What did they study? Did they go to college? Doesn't matter if they did or didn't, but you should at least find out what is your background. I mean, have you been doing insurance your entire life? What else did you used to do? So those would be some of the ways to evaluate the agent. Then I'm going to assume, listener, you already know, maybe not the specific annuity you want, but I think you probably know the type: SPIA, DIA, MIGA, fixed indexed annuity, if that's appropriate for you. I'm not a big fan of those anymore. I used to be, but not so much anymore. So you might know the type of annuity you're looking for. So go in and be prepared to ask them about the annuities. What can you tell me about this annuity? It's what I'm thinking of buying. You know, what are the pros and cons of it? And just kind of do your due diligence that way. That's how I would approach it. Anything you can think of, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's good. And a good indication of a good agent is they're also probably not going to just take you at your, hey, I want to buy this, and then you just go with it. You know, a salesperson, that's their dream. Somebody walks in and they say, I want to buy this. And they say, that was easy sale. I'm just going to go for it, fill out the paperwork, and move ahead. A good agent, I think, that's doing their job and is going to say, well, let's, you know, make sure that tell me what you're wanting it to accomplish, and let's make sure that that's the best thing for you, and see what their logic is. If they contort themselves trying to shove you down what you know to be a high commissioned product, and you were looking for a SPIA, for instance, they better have some really compelling arguments as to why that makes sense, and don't fall for the, oh, you don't pay me the commission. The insurance company pays me the commission. No, you pay the commission. You're going to pay the commission, because if they weren't paying the commission, more benefits could flow to you. So you're ultimately, policyholders ultimately pay the commissions to all of these commission salespeople. Commissions aren't inherently bad, but if they're, you know, just, you just want to make sure that that conflict of interest isn't driving them towards suggesting something. They might have a very good explanation, and they should be able to describe it to you. Hey, they ask you, what do you want it to do? You say, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. And they say, you know, you asked for this, but let me talk to you about this other thing over here, and these are the reasons why I think it would be better for you, and they should be able to clearly delineate the differences between the two and why they think the other is better. I think that's a good indicator that they cared enough to find out what you're trying to accomplish so that you end up getting into the right thing. That's somebody who's serving people should be doing, is making sure that they're, you know, considering what's best for the person. They have no obligation to do so. So if they do that, I think kudos to them.
Right. And do recognize, and Chris is right, there's nothing wrong with a commission. There truly isn't. That's how insurance is distributed. There are quote-unquote commission-free annuities, and we'll be talking about them in greater detail in June Annuity Awareness Month. But some annuity types, especially the kind that Chris and I favor, we use a commission-free or fee-based annuity wholesaler. And I've been asking them in the 3 years that I've been using them, do you have any SPIAs yet? Do you have any SPIAs yet? Do you have any SPIAs yet? I sound like a broken record. They keep telling me the same thing. SPIAs are not distributed on the fee basis. So certain annuities, SPIAs in particular, are only available with a commission being paid. LTC insurance, for the most part, is all commission-based. Life insurance. The only annuities are MIGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities, variable annuities, and fixed income annuities. Those three types of annuities are also distributed on a fee-based basis. But that does not mean it's the better annuity for you. But ask your agent, how are you going to be paid? Are you going to be paid a commission, or am I going to be paying a fee to you? Are you using a commission product or a fee-based product? 90%+ of all annuities, even variable annuities, fixed indexed annuities, and MIGAs, are distributed on a commission basis. The quote-unquote fee-based basis is very small. And there's only a few insurance companies offering it. And you have to look at what you will end up net of the fee you're going to pay the advisor. With a commission product, everything's rolled into it. Here's what you're getting. Here's your guaranteed interest rate. Here's your cap rate. Here's your payout, whatever type of annuity you're buying. Here it is. You see it all. It's right there. This is what I'm getting. In a fee-based annuity, you got to adjust for what you're going to pay to buy it. So don't shy away from asking how are you going to be paid. But don't be shocked if he or she tells you, I earn a commission. They're most likely going to word it the way Chris said, oh, don't worry, you don't pay me, the insurance company pays me. And technically, they're correct. The insurance company is going to pay them, not you. But technically, they're also lying to you. You are going to pay them, because it's going to be reflected in whatever income payout, cap rate, or interest rate the insurance company is going to give you already reflects the money that the insurance company is going to give the agent or the producer selling you the policy. So I hate when people say, or agents say, oh, don't worry, you don't pay me, the insurance company pays me. They should just level with you and say, you don't pay me outright. The insurance company pays me, and they have structured your fee into how the policy performs and what the interest rate, income benefit, or cap rate, whatever type of annuity you're buying, is going to pay you. That's how they should answer that question. I know all you do-it-yourselfers are loathe to pay a commission, but when it comes to insurance, it's going to be hard to avoid. It's not impossible to avoid, but it's going to be hard to avoid. That's just how insurance is distributed. When you buy your auto insurance, you're paying a commission. When you buy your homeowner's insurance, you're paying a commission. When I used to have a boat and had boat insurance, I paid a commission. My health insurance, I'm paying a commission. It's all rolled in there. That's how insurance is distributed. But for some reason, people freak out because the annuity or the long-term care policy or the life insurance policy is going to pay a commission. All insurance. I got news for you folks. You've been paying insurance commissions your whole lives. Anyways, just wanted to throw that in there too. Okay, I think we beat that horse to death. And let's get to the two HSAs and wrap this up because I got to get going. So both of these are kind of related, Chris. So the first one says, my husband is 69 and employed. I'm 63 and not employed. He signed up for Medicare Part A, which is the free one, when he turned 65, because he was told he should, even though we don't use Medicaid. His employer actually offers, and we continue to pay, for a qualified HSA medical plan that he's eligible for. When we found out recently, though, that he cannot actually be signed up for Medicare at the same time he contributes to an HSA account, which has been for the past year and a half, we had to stop our HSA contributions. So my first question is what we just found out true? Why don't you answer that one?
It's absolutely true. And I think what a couple things burn people on this. One, if you have enough credits accumulated in the Medicare system, Social Security / Medicare system, Part A becomes free. The premium is $0. So people kind of forget about it. And, or in this case, they signed up for it. And why not? Because it's free. If it gives you a little benefit, why would you turn down a free benefit? The downside is there's this absolute rule that if you're signed up for any portion of Medicare, even if it's just Part A, which doesn't get any attention really, because for most people it's free, just kind of comes, you know, as an automatic. Even if you're signed up just for A, that bars you from making an HSA contribution. The other related thing that burns people is when you claim Social Security benefits, if you are 65 years old or older, you automatically get Part A. And if you have a Social Security retirement benefit, you automatically qualify for the free. And so the law was written to make sure people got their free benefit. So it forces it or thrusts it upon people. There's no way to turn it down. So if you even innocently don't actively sign up for Medicare, knowing you'd like to continue your HSA contributions, if you claim Social Security and you are 65 or older, you're going to get Part A and immediately become ineligible to make an HSA contribution. That one stings people all the time because there's a lot of people who sign up at their full retirement age, realizing, you know, they're avoiding the earnings test so they can keep working. They're working at an employer who provides them with medical, and so they don't need Medicare. They didn't realize that when they signed up for Social Security, they automatically get Part A, and there's no way to turn it down. So be aware of both of those things, but it's what they learned is absolutely true. If you're in Medicare at all, no HSA contributions can be made.
Okay. So what I want to do is help you clean this mess up. You, from my understanding, have 2 years, because you've been doing this for a year and a half, so I would assume you contributed over two separate tax years, but I could be wrong. But you have an excess contribution to your HSA. And you will fix those just like you will any excess contribution to an IRA would. You are going to file and use Form 5329. You need to use a 5329 for the tax year of each excess contribution. However, you have until October 15th of the year following the excess contribution to correct it and not pay the 6% penalty tax. But to fix the excess, you have to withdraw it from the HSA. You have to file Form 5329, but you also have to tell the custodian you are making a corrective distribution. Just don't call up the custodian and say, send me, let's just say you put in $3,000 and you weren't supposed to, and you're trying to get it out before October 15th of the year following because you want to avoid paying a 6% penalty on that $3,000. Don't just call up the HSA custodian and say, send me $3,000. They're going to mark that as just a distribution. You need a corrective distribution to prove to the IRS you are taking out the excess contribution. So you'll just tell your custodian that, hey, I contributed, I shouldn't have. I need to make a corrective distribution of $3,000. They will take out 3,000 less any gains, minus any losses. So keep that in mind. So you might get a little bit more or a little bit less than $3,000, but you will take that back out. Now, if you deducted all that on your taxes, you're also going to have to file some amended returns and fix all that as well. But you need to fix those excess contributions or run the risk that the IRS catches you within the statute of limitations period and nails you. Or you can say, you know, no harm, no foul, I'll just keep quiet. I'm certainly not advocating that, but it wouldn't have been unheard of that some people may just say, oh, no more, let me not put anything else in. But you are supposed to fix it. And you fix it with Form 5329, which has ample instructions in the instruction part of 5329 on how to fix an HSA excess contribution. Then she asks one more thing, and we'll have to wrap it up after this, because actually the next question I want to get to has another question similar to it, so we'll do it next week. But she wraps up by simply saying, I have a related question. Can we contribute to this HSA account still? No, we already answered that.
Well,
if we...
Whose is it? I forget from the original part of the... I was going to add this nuance. Maybe it's not a problem unless they're both on Part A. If only one of them.
No, that would be a problem, actually. To determine eligibility, you have to look at the HSA owner. And if the HSA owner is not eligible, nobody is eligible. So he is the owner.
To go to that HSA, though, but she might be able to be doing one if she's not signed up for Medicare Part A. So those HSAs are individual.
Hold on. I anticipated this, not from you. So I reached out to none other than the Ed Slot Group. And they wrote, to determine eligibility, we look at the HSA owner and the type of insurance they have. So if the HSA owner is not eligible to contribute, then all contributions would be excess contributions. I don't see how any part could be an allowable contribution here. So I asked them that question.
Yeah, that's if it's going into the person who's disallowed. Was she very clear that they weren't putting it in each of their separate HSAs? Was it all going into a spot where it was disallowed? And even if they were, it's something they could change. And if they're going to continue to be in this situation and she is not on Part A.
I wrote this. I had to tell her, I'm assuming, this is my question now to the Ed Slot Group. I said, I'm assuming they are on a family plan. So I would also assume some of their contributions may be able to remain in it because the wife is not 65 yet, nor is she enrolled in Medicare. Only the husband has enrolled. So again, they're saying no.
You're missing my point. You're acting like it's a joint HSA. It's not. It's his, which is disallowed because he's disallowed. She could have her own HSA and be making full family contributions to her HSA. So their solution, before she turns 65 and makes the same mistake of going on Part A, they could switch over and start doing that. That doesn't avoid them having to fix this over contribution to his, but they might actually have an opening to still make HSA contributions to hers.
Interesting. You're saying that perhaps the husband has the high deductible health care plan and he's ineligible to participate. But if it is a family plan, your contention is, and I'll ask the Ed Slot Group this. I just want to make sure, and we'll announce it next week because we're going to continue with the other HSA questions as well. See how exciting this is, folks? Chris was topless. We went to an Irma question, and now we have a continuing HSA question.
They're going to agree with me. Because everyone has their own individual HSA. It's not a family HSA.
Individual, but can't she make a family contribution because he's not eligible?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, I'm telling you. The answer is yes, and because we've looked into this before.
The key,
if you look at the qualifications to make an HSA contribution, the key is simply, are you enrolled in a family plan? If you're enrolled in an eligible, high deductible family plan, you can make the full family contribution. Doesn't matter if other family members are disallowed or not. if you're enrolled and you're otherwise eligible to do it, you can make the family size contribution. So not only can she make her own individual, she could make the full family, but it has to go into her HSA because she's not disallowed.
And what I do know is she could not do the catch-up for him into her HSA.
You can't do that.
So that catch-up right. is not allowed.
She could do the full family plus her own catch-up until she goes on to Medicare. And they, as long
I will
as they
confirm that. It yeah. sounds correct. Now, I vaguely remember we did talk about this in the past. Yeah. That sounds correct. But let me just confirm with the Ed Slot Group folks on that. Her main question was, can they take money from it? They have $1.8 million, she says, in an IRA. So she continues. I got to wrap this up. She says, we have $1.8 million in IRAs. And only 718,000 outside of IRAs. We would love to move some of these pre-tax IRA dollars into the HSA if we can. Can we do that? If so, how much per year can we do? Yeah. Assuming you could, first of all, your husband is not allowed to, so it cannot come from his IRA. It would have to come from your IRA. And it's only if Chris is right. And he very well may be, but I will confirm all this by next week. But you can only contribute from your IRA what the family maximum amount is. And no one, you can't have made any other contribution. So only in 1 year and 1 year only, and only what the maximum amount you are allowed to put in, including your catch up, but not including your husband's catch up. That cannot come from your IRA, nor can it go into your HSA.
Yeah, it's a one-time lifetime election, and it effectively takes the place of your contribution that year. It's just a way to move money from your IRA to an HSA when you wouldn't want to take other monies to make the contribution. That's all you're affecting, and they only let you do it once, not annually.
But you still have to fix your husband's excess?
Yep.
You cannot make up for the HSA contribution. I don't know when you made the first one, but you can't put that back for a prior tax year, but you can make up for this year. And I think you have, I could be wrong on this, until, and now she doesn't have much time because it's almost 10 days is April 15th, but I'm wondering if she could fix the old one first. Could she then contribute into hers by April 15th for last year? Do you know if you can make an HSA contribution? I don't know off the top of my head. By April 15th for a prior year? Is it like a Roth?
Know that. I should
is it
know
like
that.
A Roth conversion that must be done by December
31st? No, I think it's
like
an IRA contribution. So it's April 15th, yep.
Okay. So you could theoretically, if you made a 2023 contribution into your husband's, fix that because it was an excess contribution. But you also have until the 15th, assuming Chris is right, and you can Google it because I'm not going to have the answer till next week's show. But if Chris is correct, and I believe he is, that your husband has the qualifying plan, but he can't contribute to his. But you could contribute the family maximum to yours because you have
as long as you're on that same plan,
mm-hmm. qualifying high deductible plan. So you could make up 2023's by April 15th, fix your husband's, and put 2024's in. But if your husband made a 2022 contribution, you can't fix that.
No,
you got to remove that one, and you aren't going to be allowed to get that one into yours.
Yeah, you got to fix that with 5329.
Yes, yeah. I said that at the beginning of the show. 5329 for each tax year that needs to be fixed, and you have to get that specific form 5329. So you got to Google 2022 form 5329, 2023 form 5329, and you got to file each one to fix each excess contribution. A lot of work you got to do there. But it can be fixed.
Yep.
Okay. We do have two more HSA questions we'll get to next week, so that's excitement.
Oh, yeah.
All righty. I got to run. I'm running late to meet a friend. So thanks, folks. Chris is going to wrap up, and I've got to go.
Okay. Sounds good. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you. You too.
For everybody else, thanks again for listening in. If you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. As we said before, in the subject line, put that it's a question for the podcast and a couple words about the topic. That's very helpful. Concise, direct questions are always preferred. Obviously, we need enough detail to answer it, but don't get overboard with the detail. That tends to bog things down a little bit, but we do appreciate the questions being sent in. We'll also take your recommendations as to how we might spice up the show, freshen it up a little bit moving forward. We'll consider anything, pretty much. I don't think we'll continue the shirtless approach, but we'll see how popular that was, this particular show. So take care, everybody, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.